We're looking at the persistent issue of academic bullying on college campuses on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It can manifest in many different ways: intimidation, humiliation, perhaps undermining a scientist's authority in their lab. The Wisconsin State Journal, it did a multi-part investigation into UW-Madison cases. Have you experienced bullying in a workplace setting? How did it affect your life? What should universities do to discourage bullying behaviors? And please take care and note, we will be talking about one case that involves suicide. It's 800-642-1234. Kelly Meyerhofer covers higher education for the Wisconsin State Journal. Kelly, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for inviting me, Kate.
So is there a clear way to define academic bullying? What is it? What can you tell us about this terminology?
Yeah, academic bullying is kind of a shorthand. There's a variety of different behaviors that it can present itself as. There's shouting, intimidating a student, threatening them, trying to cancel their funding, giving them an impossible workload, offering negative references to employers. These are just some of the examples that I've heard about.
And UW-Madison identifies academic bullying as, quote, hostile and intimidating behavior. And the things that you've just said would, you know, perhaps fall into that category.
Yeah, they broadly define it as unwelcome behavior, so perversive or severe that it impairs another person's ability to carry out their work responsibilities. And they offer, you know, several different examples of what that can look like, but it is a fairly subjective definition and requires some judgment calls.
You know, when I scroll through the scholarly articles, the blog posts, the news articles like yours, and I get the sense that academic bullying cuts across all campuses, that it's really out there. But where is the data? What do the numbers say? And I'm just wondering, did you come across reliable data in your reporting?
It's become a more recent academic topic. I talked to one expert who's really started researching the issue. He's done like a global survey with, I think, more than 2,000 respondents. But in terms of like each, if you want to look at your specific university, the data is hard to get. I was able to find different cases through news tips and specific records requests. And that's in part because Wisconsin's public records law allows for these investigations when they're closed to be released. Private universities, you know, typically don't ever talk about these cases unless it makes it into the media. And a lot of other state laws, you know, protect employee investigations.
So with your records request, what were you trying to find out? What were you trying to see?
Well, I identified from like 2016 through 2021, I identified 9 UW-Madison employees who were investigated for violating this hostile and intimidating behavior policy. And so I got the whole investigation that the university did in those cases. And there were a couple different common themes that I found in looking at those cases.
What were the themes that came out?
Well, in a lot of the cases, in at least 5 of them, UW-Madison had received complaints either verbally or in writing, or had documented previous concerns about the employee for this type of behavior even before there was the formal investigation and report that I had received. About half of the employees had left for other jobs after being investigated. About the other half, they still remain at the university.
Was it hard for people to talk? And whether it were, you know, the accuser or the person who had been in the bullying situation, what was it like to do these interviews?
Yeah, for the people that had been bullied, it was a lot of conversations with them. Many of them were not willing to be named. Some of them are still in academia and fear that being named could harm their reputation or potential career prospects. But some students were really willing to be named, and they wanted to have this information out there about their experience and sort of to warn future students about professors who may still be working in their job.
Yeah, I mean, you cover all aspects of higher ed. What sent you down this path? Why did you want to probe this very deeply?
Well, I mean, it started actually in 2019. I had gotten a report on a graduate student who died by suicide in 2016. He was in the College of Engineering, and he had worked under an advisor who treated him really poorly, called him an animal, a slave. It just was like an impossible workload. And after that story published, I received, you know, many tips about, you know, this is just like the lab here. This is just like my professor. And so I started, you know, just looking into more cases. And I found, you know, I mean, I didn't find any other suicide, but I did find a number of students who sort of suffer in silence through these abusive situations or leave academia altogether.
And the graduate student you wrote about was John Brady, who died by suicide. And I'm wondering, how is Brady's legacy affecting how UW goes about its policy today?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, if you talk to the university, their position is that they really, that they found that case obviously deeply troubling. And, you know, it prompted them to make a lot of different changes. You know, they have this hostile and intimidating behavior policy, and a lot of other universities, you know, like in the Big Ten, don't even have a specific policy calling out this behavior. It's sort of folded into, you know, behavioral expectations. I found an academic paper last year that was published that highlighted encouraging work at a few different universities, and UW-Madison was one of that handful that was given credit for
that's interesting.
Steps to try to address the behavior. Yeah.
What did it call out? What did it find at UW-Madison that's different from elsewhere or that highlighted steps forward?
Well, they have, you know, this very specific policy saying this behavior is not tolerated at all. And they also have like a website specifically for this behavior. It brings visibility to the problem, and it lays out, you know, how people can report this behavior and what resources they have at their disposal.
Talking with Kelly Meyerhofer, who covers higher education for the Wisconsin State Journal, we're discussing her reporting on academic bullying and cases that she looked into, 9 cases at UW-Madison. You can join in. What would you like to know about these investigations or what it means for hostile and intimidating behavior, whether it's a lab setting or elsewhere, another workplace setting? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Steve in Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve. What's on your mind?
Hi. Yeah. Conservatives have been talking about academic bullying for a decade now, maybe even longer, about how many groomers there are in schools that masquerade as teachers. And these kids are afraid to, you know, articulate their beliefs because of concerns about bad grades or being ostracized by the teacher. We also see it in K-12, but definitely in colleges. Wondering what your guest thoughts are on that.
Steve, thanks. So Steve pointing to religious beliefs and that impacting a bullying.
Yeah, that's a good question, Steve. You know, my investigation focused, you know, pretty narrowly on academic bullying. You know, I haven't, this investigation didn't really look at like religious or political discrimination in the classroom, but that's obviously a topic that falls under my umbrella as a higher education reporter.
Another case you looked into was the tenured entomology professor, Joanne Brunet, who had a joint arrangement with the USDA. Her position at UW-Madison was fully paid by the USDA. What was involved in this case?
Yeah, this was a pretty big case. I mean, she started at the university in 2003, but she continued to be paid by USDA. They opened an investigation in 2017, UW did, and USDA also opened their own investigation into her behavior and also allegations of scientific misconduct. And UW was moving to fire her. She agreed to resign in 2019. But she still works for the USDA and runs a lab there where she oversees postdocs and undergraduate students.
And the USDA wouldn't cooperate with your investigating?
Yeah, they just, I mean, I sent them a list of questions. I put in a federal records request. They denied that. They said that they don't discuss personnel matters and just gave me a statement saying that their agency's success hinges on a workplace environment that's free from harassment and retaliation.
Her grad students and lab assistants recount her yelling at them and telling them that their work wouldn't amount to much. But you also surfaced some research misconduct, some data issues.
Yeah, I talked to a few different people who worked in her lab who said that that she pressured them to use falsified data that was taken, you know, from multiple different sites in different years, and it was not, you know, following the scientific principles of research. And they said that they talked to the USDA, filed complaints, tried to get an investigation going. I was unable to find out from the agency what, if anything, came of those very serious allegations.
Is there a jurisdiction here? I mean, because you're an employee of the USDA, but you're also this tenured professor at UW-Madison. I mean, so what is UW-Madison's role here? And you know, how much weight should they be in investigating what is ultimately not entirely their employee?
Yeah, I mean, when you talk to people in our lab, some of them really don't blame UW-Madison at all for these sorts of problems that were occurring in our lab for more than a decade. You know, they were USDA employees and they felt that their complaint should go to that agency. You know, other people are harsher on UW-Madison and say the university was definitely aware of the problems, you know, going back years, and that they should have done more. But it is, you know, a different situation in that she had a dual appointment with two different employers. So that made it a little more tricky, I think, to really pin down the problem and address it.
Wisconsin State Journal's higher education reporter Kelly Meyerhofer has been investigating cases of academic bullying at UW-Madison, how the university has responded over the years. What was your experience as a grad student? What actions have you taken to remedy a hostile work environment? Still time, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The provost of Georgetown University wrote a blog post titled Bullying in 2020. In it, he said that reports of interpersonal conflict, or what could be labeled bullying, were on a concerning rise at his university, and that the insidious problem of bullying in an organization is that it has widespread effect. The Wisconsin State Journal investigated academic bullying cases at UW-Madison in recent years. Still time to talk about this, 800-642-1234. The State Journal's higher ed reporter and author of the investigative reports, Kelly Meyerhofer, with us for about 9 more minutes. Kelly, UW-Madison officials told you that they take a progressive discipline approach, that they'd much rather work with the person being accused. Can you kind of take us through what that means?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the university, unless the behavior is really egregious, they want to work with the employee and try to get them to change their behavior and improve. And that's what they said that is a widely used best practice in human resources and higher education. So there's many some employees who have been investigated by the university who still work there and are going through this progressive disciplinary approach where the university says that they are monitoring them to make sure that their behavior changes.
Do you have any specifics as to what this approach is? What are the steps of the monitoring?
Yeah, I mean, I looked at one case in the College of Engineering, a professor who had been accused of verbal abuse by a graduate student of his in 2012. And then he was investigated again in 2016 for students who said that he verbally abused them, threatened to cancel their funding, threatened to delay their graduation. He's in that progressive disciplinary approach right now. The university said that they're monitoring his lab, But in talking with, you know, most of his graduate students, a lot of them couldn't really recall any sort of monitoring taking place, any sort of meetings with the department to ask about, you know, what the lab environment was like. So that case for me, it raised questions about how thorough the university is in keeping tabs on professors who have been investigated before for this behavior.
And it seems like college campuses and their HR departments really lean into training, really lean into workshops. You know, I've been an employee of three universities, one community college in my career. And I feel like I especially see that here at UW-Madison, where I want to say Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of UW-Madison, which means I am an employee. And so I'm wondering, Kelly, does going through training show that it stops or at least, you know, kind of stamps out the academic bullying? Does it work?
That's a really good question. I mean, you know, the university's position is that they have this training for hostile and intimidating behavior that, you know, more than nearly 3,000 people have taken, and they're, you know, they have an in-person training, they're launching an online training. So they're saying, you know, that people are doing this training. I mean, but the question is whether it works. I mean, training is not required. It's strongly encouraged that employees take this training. I've come across a few cases where employees accused of this behavior have gotten, you know, anger management training, specific training for this behavior. And graduate students have told me, you know, the professor comes back to the lab and they sort of make jokes about having to do this training. So It does raise questions about whether it's effective or not. I talked to an expert who said it's really not that effective.
Let's look at federal research agencies, in particular, the National Institutes of Health that you looked at. These agencies like the NIH taking steps to actually remove funding from 90 PIs, 90 principal investigators. What did you see there?
Yeah, the National Institutes of Health, NIH, they in the past couple of years set up a system where people who, you know, are working in a lab that's funded by NIH can submit complaints. And the agency does investigate some of these cases and works with the university to see if they've investigated them and has removed funding from professors who have sexually harassed or bullied people in their labs. So that's a really encouraging step for that agency. I mean, there's obviously a lot of different federal research agencies, and I think NIH is kind of a pioneer in this regard. Other agencies have not gone this far yet, in part because, you know, doing these investigations is a lot of resources for the agency.
Sure, absolutely. So where do you go from here with this investigation? What do you watch for?
Oh, that's a good question. Where do I go? I don't know. I mean, this is a issue that I don't think is going away. I think, you know, I talked to the chancellor about this, and, you know, there's some parallels that can be drawn between this and sexual assault and harassment. It's going to always persist, you know, and there's going to have to be investigations to address this sort of behavior, but, university says that they're really trying to create a culture where people feel more comfortable in reporting. And so I think that will lead to more investigations. I think, you know, writing about this behavior makes people more aware that this is a problem. I think it you know, this issue has gotten a lot less attention than sexual assault and harassment. But I think people are becoming more aware of this problem in academia.
And outgoing UW-Madison Chancellor Rebecca Blank did tell you she wants to believe most grad students have positive relationships with their advisors, with the professors. But, I mean, what a gigantic power imbalance. There are PhDs hanging. There are careers hanging here. I mean, and I just look at that power imbalance and I say, well, that is a very tricky situation there that could be very tenuous.
Yeah, I mean, the students I talked to, it's just kind of soul crushing to hear what they went through in these labs. I mean, obviously their experiences, I talked to, I don't know, a couple dozen students, you know, and there's thousands of graduate students on campus. So their experiences are in no way representative of the entire campus, but there really is a power imbalance. These professors sort of in a way held their these students' lives and careers in their hands and have so much power over them and their futures. So,
well, in our last minute together or so, I'm reflecting on your tweet the other day where you said to bear with you, to give you a chance to report out this rare issue where a chancellor speaks out against the system leadership. I'm wondering if you could just give us up to speed at what you're finding about UW-Whitewater, the interim chancellor, Jim Henderson, resigning this week.
Yeah, that was an unusual case. There's a free speech survey that all UW system students are going to start receiving today that's being funded by a UW Stout Center. And the way in which this has been described to me, you know, chancellors were pretty opposed to this free speech survey being sent out for a variety of reasons. And the interim Whitewater chancellor decided to resign over the system, which initially decided it wouldn't send out the survey after hearing chancellor's concerns, later backtracked and decided it would be sent out. So the chancellor did resign earlier this week over that decision.
That's pretty major. What is in the survey that would cause this?
I think for him, the issue was, there were some concerns about what was in the survey, but also just about how the system initially, went along with chancellors who had concerns and then reversed that decision and said that it would be sending out the survey. You know, Jim Henderson, the interim Whitewater chancellor, told me that there's a lack of support from UW system leadership. He thought that chancellors, had a collaborative role in decision-making with the system. And he felt like that sort of agreement was not honored in this case and some others. He's worked with the system before in a variety of positions. So he said he couldn't in good faith try to recruit a permanent chancellor for the Whitewater campus while knowing that this was the situation that he felt existed.
Kelly, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Kate.
Kelly Meyerhofer on the Ideas Network.